This is Everything is Workable, a podcast where we examine how every experience, every situation, every moment is an opportunity to work with our mind. I'm your host, Caitlin Hatch, creative polymath and dedicated consumer of wisdom. In this season, I'm talking to other people about their approach to life and practice. Today's episode is with Lou Flores, a practitioner of a rich collection of indigenous spirituality, including Orisha, Bakongo, Hoodoo, and various pagan traditions, to name just a few. Let me dispel any thoughts that this might be an airy-fairy episode. Lou is a spiritual warrior with a solid, down-to-earth approach to life. He shares the importance of honoring and understanding lineage and the root of these traditions, as well as not taking yourself too seriously. Content notification, there's a little bit of swearing in this. If you enjoyed this episode, please share it. Your support in getting this in front of an ever wider audience is hugely appreciated. You can also visit CaitlinSCHatch.com to leave a tip and to help fund the production of the show. And now on to my conversation with Lou. Thank you so much, by the way, for taking the time to do this.
Anytime.
So generally, I start out by asking my guests to talk about their practice and approach to life, and my guests thus far have largely been from kind of recognizable communities like Christian, Buddhist, secular, that kind of thing. But you come from a background that probably fewer people, and especially white people, will be familiar with. Or I think maybe a better way of putting it is that you have a practice as a spirit worker and medicine maker that a lot of people think they know, but they probably know it from like a Hollywood version or a very appropriated version of it. So just to start us off, if you could riff on your spiritual practice for a bit, especially because I don't even try to pronounce things because I will sound like an idiot.
So I'm Lou Flores, and my spiritual given name is Awo Ifa Dunsin. Awo means high priest in training in the Orisha traditions, which are spread across the diaspora, starting in Nigeria is where it was born. And then through the Middle Passage, it got planted and seeded in the Americas, specifically around the islands like Haiti and Cuba and Puerto Rico. Here in the United States, it came in through Atlanta, Florida, all the kind of southern region where the slave trade happened. In Brazil and South America, it was also planted and seeded. While we all work with some of the same Orishas, which are, an Orisha means elevated spirit or elevated consciousness. The traditions diverge in how those specific populations engage with their specific form of slavery and their specific form of oppressions and their specific like tribal traditions, which came in through the Middle Passage. So in the Orisha tradition, that's my official name, and it means Ifa is sweet to me. Or Ifa. Let Ifa, and Ifa is Orunmila, who was the first prophet in the Africa traditions who walked like manifested as a spiritual being on the earth.
Okay.
And they claim that he came into being and walked, you know, like presently on the earth about 10,000 years ago.
Okay.
And he was the one that brought all these divergent tribal traditions together and formulated a kind of umbrella type of tradition, if that makes sense. So that's one aspect of my practice, or one aspect of the way I walk in the world. I also am a pagan and a witch and do a lot of neo-pagan type of traditions, like, you know, people know about Wicca and those type of offshoots of Wicca and witchcraft and European-based magics, folk traditions. I also am a hoodoo practitioner and root worker, which is specifically a southern witchcraft, southern folk tradition, which is the kind of amalgamation of a lot of what you see in Orisha work, like in the diasporic traditions of Orisha and Vodun and African magic folklore traditions that, because of the way that slavery hit the United States, Catholicism wasn't a dominant or predominant. And so the Pentecostal movements wiped away the spirit or the religion aspect, and what was left was the kind of the quote-unquote magical cures, housewife remedies type of situations. So we had the African part of the folk magic. Then you have, because of displacement and what was considered white at the time, different populations of European-based folk tradition that are added in because those communities at the time were considered not white. So you have Italian, you have Irish, you have, you know, Jewish. And so all those populations, both, you know, African and those populations of European descent who weren't considered, you know, and class was also part of it, weren't considered, quote unquote, under the white population, they had no resource. And so what do? You talk amongst people who are treated like yourself, and you share your traditions and share what's going on. And then also starting like in the mid to late 1900s, or mid to late, 1900s, like around like 1920, 1930, into the 40s and 50s, the Latin American magics and folk traditions got added and amalgamated into it. And so it's basically an umbrella term for the folk traditions of everything that you see in the South.
Right.
And the diasporic like populations and folk traditions of everyone who was kind of oppressed and not considered white and kind of in the working class populations.
Right. So like unity through the experience of marginalization and poverty.
Yep. And very much how you know, like see a lot of the GLBT populations happening right now of like, okay, we might not look the same or be in the same class, but hell, we have to fight for each other.
Yeah.
Hopefully. So that's one. That's one. And then I also do Latin American curanderismo, which is one of my private traditions that I don't teach from because I haven't been given license to. And that looks that stems from Mexican native traditions that were, I mean, some of them are completely native. Some of them are come through the lens of Catholicism. And what else do? I was raised Catholic, so work with the saints a lot, and specifically through the Catholic tradition versus like all these other kind of ways in which saint worship is, you know. So I work through saints both like in Catholicism and then through like the hoodoo version, southern version of working with the saints. And then also like with the translation of how they get amalgamated into or syncretized with the Orishas and some of the other forms of Orisha spirituality.
So like a very rich spiritual background with a lot of different aspects, but sounds like a lot of overlap as well. So as a Buddhist and as somebody who really appreciates lineage, because I know not everybody who practices Buddhism appreciates lineage, but for me that is something that I've really come to see the value in. So in understanding that lineage is because Buddhism was always a verbal tradition that was passed down, and the idea of transmission was actually like you're from teacher to student, you taught it to the student until the student embodied it, and when they embodied it then you could trust that they could teach it because they weren't just learning something from a book. They were walking the walk and really, really living it. So I really appreciate that. And I see how important that is. And it's something I really take into my practice. So how important, like, it sounds like lineage is very important in everything that you do. So could you just talk a little bit about, like, you've just said there's something that you practice, but you don't teach it yet because you're not ready. So could you talk a little bit about, I guess, your experience of study and practice and embodiment and connecting to lineage and how you work on integrating these things into your life?
Absolutely. And my experience is that most earth-based practices, and I mean, for me, I would consider Buddhist an earth-based practice in a lot of ways. And what I mean by that is pre-industrialization and where the peoples who practiced spiritual traditions were observing it in their natural like environments as ways of working and living and all and being in the world and being connected to the world, regardless of whether it was like the you know, seeing the Dakinis as some female divine principle or actual goddesses or however you want to, you know, engage that.
Yeah.
But for me, lineage looks like, I'm going to riff for a minute. So, because it's a complicated kind of explanation.
Yeah.
So my experience of lineage in Orisha tradition looks like the way that I was taught was that not only is it about the actual spirit and understanding the understanding like the archetypical or like the kind of the symbolic form of that being, but the lineage gives you the embodiment of the practitioners who engage engage that spirit in their daily lives.
Okay, so is that sort of like how the like looking at reincarnation in Buddhist lineage, how His Holiness the Dalai Lama is meant to be a representation of Avalokiteshvara?
Very similar, but also in the fact that every person who you study under gives their spiritual energy or ashe to you.
Okay,
so every time that I do ceremony, I call on every priest that has ever touched the head or the energy of the priest who birthed me.
Mm-hmm.
And so I know not only their teachers, but the teachers before them and the teachers before them. And then their group of kind of like secondary teachers, they're called Ajibonas, which is in case something ever was to happen to your main teacher, who would you go to if you needed support?
Right.
You know?
Yeah.
And so that's kind of what lineage looks like to me. And so it's not just about engaging that principle or that energy, but it's the way that that energy was filtered through the heart and transmitted to the student.
So it's about the teacher as much as it is about the teaching.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. And so that's also the way that I was taught. Is that, you know, because there's very different discourses, specifically in Orisha tradition, around like this idea of the punishing kind of spirit, or the, you know, if you do this wrong, your left ear is going to fall off and you're going to, you know, be, you know, your leg's going to be amputated and yada, 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 you know?
Yeah.
And so that's not what spoke to me, and that's not the reason why I was in those lineages. And so the lineage that I'm a part of, definitely looks at Orishas as uplifting and loving entities, and that while they might not protect us if we're being crazy and doing things that we shouldn't be doing in terms of, you know, treating people bad and, you know, but that's because we're out of our character versus that they're punishing us.
Mm-hmm.
If that makes sense.
Yeah. It's sort of like the, like if you, from a Christian perspective, like blaming God, or from the Buddhist perspective, like, oh, it's karma. And it's like, well, yes, but karma is because you did something. It's like you, and with God, hey, you have free will.
Yes, exactly. Exactly.
Yeah.
And so, you know, God's not going to like protect you from stepping out into the intersection. If you know what I mean? Like at the end of the day, that's your choice.
Yeah. You know? Take some personal responsibility.
Yes, absolutely. Absolutely. Right. Cool. So that's what lineage looks like in more of the Orisha traditions. Mm-hmm. In paganism, for me, my experience is very similar in terms of who your teachers are, what you studied, what their specific expertise were in witchcraft, how they kind of, what their specific medicine is, mm-hmm. you know, and what they kind of carried. And one of the things as a teacher myself is being able to kind of give the lineage of where I learned a thing. Mm-hmm. So whenever I teach ritual or teach spellcraft or whatever, I recognize the teacher who taught me that. And while I don't know necessarily all their teachers, like in the Orisha tradition, at least it gives a grounding of, you know, at this time, at this place, this is how spirit emerged and created a thing that, mm-hmm. may or may not work for you, but depending on where your circumstances are. But this is what I learned, kind of thing.
Yeah.
And then in hoodoo, very much the same thing. I mean, basically it's all this. For me, it's the same.
Yeah. How would you test? Because I think with something like this, and with almost any spiritual practice anyway, but particularly in ones that get appropriated a lot, how do you test the legitimacy of a teacher? What is guidance that you've found very helpful?
It's really a gray area for me, let me put it that way. And just because I don't think that somebody's legitimate doesn't mean that their lineage isn't legitimate,
Right, yeah.
if that makes sense.
Yeah.
And I think for me, one of the big things is it affirming of my life and the way that I want to live? And do I want to emulate the life that that specific teacher is living, in
Yeah.
as much as I see it? And some of the red flags for me look like definitely like cost prohibited. And what does that look like in terms of making a living off of these traditions? And not that, I mean, I work as a priest in community. It's not that I don't charge, but is it tailored to a specific class group? And even that is a little bit tricky because there
Yeah.
are legitimate teachers who teach $1,500 workshops and have the lineage, but for me, my politics don't look like that. And so that kind of has kept me out of some groups in terms of what they do. Not that that isn't legitimate for the people who practice it, but for me, in terms of my politics and the way that I embody traditions, that doesn't necessarily work unless it's actually something that is, unless I can see the reasoning why there's a specific price for a thing, and there's an explanation.
Yeah, I get that. Like, I think when I look at some teachers and I really want to go and see them and it's just too expensive, but I know that, like, that's what they do. I appreciate that this is how it helps them to survive, and especially if they're a monastic or somebody who really, like, they don't work that, like, this is their job.
Absolutely. And so that's one factor for me. Another factor is, do they, and especially whenever it comes to traditions that are based out of peoples of color, like, do they acknowledge the communities where these teachings come from? Are the symbols that are being used European based, or are they based in the actual, living experience of people of color, even if they're not people of color themselves? One of the biggest things that I have an issue with, just in my own, kind of practices, is seeing these kind of bleached out statues of Orisha and things like that that look very European, in terms of their features. And that's not to say that they're not legitimate, or they're not embodying that specific Orisha, or they're not reflective of the circumstances in which that person, had an experience. But that's always, key to me is, do you acknowledge where it comes from? I mean, even for me, practicing African tradition, I am like, I mean, that's I'm not African, I'm not African American. I don't have that. But part of what I talk about is that experience, and how do I come to peace with it, and how do I give back to the communities which this was birthed from? And so, and then also not skipping over like the Middle Passage or slavery, or the thousands of ways in which it's easy to go to just talking about the spirit versus the actual history in which the spirit emerged and embodied and came into being.
Yeah, so you're not going to use the practice to go to sleep. You're using it to get woke, and that means acknowledging. Again, another aspect of the lineage is understanding the whole history of slavery and how it was brought to North America and the marginalization and the forced poverty of a lot of people and so on. So, yeah.
And also, like, my Ajibona, my secondary teacher, is a white woman, and she's the one who actually introduced me to my godmother that I have now. And so if it wasn't for her, I wouldn't actually be in the tradition, because my experiences very early on of the tradition were anti-gay, and I actually got like kicked out of communities. They took my money, but then kicked me out of the actual house once they found out that I was gay. And not that I ever hid that, but then, you know what I mean? And so that was a big thing for me, was and specifically, like, in terms of this as a pra like as a practice and something that I embodied, was it wasn't until I met this quote unquote white woman who was in, a European based folk magic tradition, and we started talking, and I saw her shrines, and I was like, oh, you practice Orisha, like, you know, and you're, you know, you're getting initiated. Like, what is, who are you? What are you doing? Like, who are you talking to? And then she introduced me to her godmother, you know, and then it was like, oh, you should meet my godmother. And I was like, oh, I know that Orisha tradition is anti-gay. Like, I don't want to pretend. And she's like, well, you might not have an issue because she's a big old lesbian. You know what I mean? So, and that was my first experience of a woman of color, a black woman, a lesbian black woman who was actually practicing the tradition and said that it was okay to be a lesbian black woman practicing the tradition.
Yeah.
You know?
That actually, oh, so this, I want to deviate a bit and follow this thread because this is really good. And I think this is a really powerful and interesting aspect. So, as a Buddhist practitioner, one of the things that I hear that is like criticisms waged against Buddhism is that it's really patriarchal, which I'm like, well, go ahead and name me a religion that isn't. I bet you're going to have to Google that. And I have heard questions presented to teachers saying, as a woman, I'm uncomfortable with this tradition because it is so heavily male based and it seems to be incredibly patriarchal. It's very sexist, and I worry about that. And the best response I ever heard was from, my listeners will not be surprised, Annie Pema Chodron.
I love Pema Chodron. Like, are you kidding me? She's a touchstone in my practice, period. Like, I,
She's my guru. She's not my official guru, but everything I read about teacher-student experience and connection and guru devotion, I'm like, Pema, all the way. So in one of the times when she was asked, she's presented this question, she said, you really just need to question whether or not the value of the teachings outweigh the criticisms you have. And if the spiritual practices don't let your criticisms blind you to something that could be incredibly beneficial. And I thought that was really good. And I think within religion generally, a lot of people totally reject religion and a lot of spiritual practices. And I get it because they've had crappy experiences with it. Like, I totally understand. So you're coming from this place of like, well, I'm gay and I have been rejected from spiritual communities. But despite that, I persist because it's not about them accepting me, it's about what works for me. So you're
And
talking about, sorry?
not only that, but also finding practitioners who mirror my experience in the world.
Yeah, exactly, right? Like you can find people who are gay and Catholic.
Yeah.
Like that doesn't not exist. So you're talking about how you have a Catholic aspect to what you practice with the saints. And I think the saints are pretty badass, basically. Like you look at a lot of the saints, you're like, wow, they're amazing. So how do you approach that? Like, what's your approach? Because I think a lot of people can get very easily into this position of like, well, no, they don't accept me, therefore I reject them. They reject me, I reject them. But it's sort of like, well, you're thinking maybe on the basis of the people, not the actual practice, not the actual spirituality.
I mean, I see the saints as holy dead people,
Yeah.
you know? And I think every tradition has their group of holy dead people, you know? And, you know, whether that's, I mean, even in Buddhist, you know what I mean? Like, there's definitely a great sense of these enlightened beings who walk the earth in some sort of embodiment, and I treat them as such. And the saints that I work with is because they're ones that I have personal relationships with who, you know, in some form or another have manifested in my life, whether it's in a, I mean, and I hate to be all woo-woo, but like in a vision or like in dreams or, you know, through some sort of big signification of them presenting themselves in my life. And so I work with them, not necessarily the whole pantheon of saints, if that makes sense. Like, Saint Augustine doesn't do shit for me. Like, let me just be real honest. You know what I mean? Saint Benedict, nah. You know, but Saint Martin de Porres, like, absolutely. He's the saint of racial conflict.
Really? I did
And
not know there
yeah,
was a saint of racial conflict. That's amazing.
absolutely. And so he showed up big time for me in Denver whenever I was doing social justice work and came into a dream and, you know, kind of announced himself. And then I saw his image like everywhere for the next 6 months, you know? And there's a lot of different saints in that way that have shown themselves in one form or another, whether it's European, you know what I mean? Like, what, like a Saint Hildegard of Bingen, I love her. Like, she's freaking
Hildegard's
brilliant.
amazing.
She's a brilliant. Like, I love that. I love her. Like, she's inspired. Like, she inspired me in so many different ways. It's not even funny. Like, talking about how the devil is, what did she say? That he can own, that he hates women because he can only imitate creation and can't create himself. And that what was another one? That the whole idea of original sin, that he spit into the womb of creation, and it was only I'm bastardizing this. Oh, it's horrible. But I mean, yeah. Anyway, there's a lot of gorgeous things about Hildegard that I just absolutely love. Saint Clare has been another saint that has popped up repeatedly for me, who's the specific saint of visions, invisible transmissions. So she's also the saint of TV and radio. Yeah.
So you said not to go woo-woo, and I think that's really good. I did a whole episode on woo and how you can tell if something is woo. And I think a lot of the time with spiritual practice, you do have these legitimate experiences of really connecting, and there's a reason these people have been sainted, and that you can connect with that. And I know as a Buddhist in meditation, I've had some intense experiences, and actually just very recently, I was in a solitary retreat for 5 days, and I had an amazing experience, which to speak about it in a public forum would, I think, belittle it and detract in a way. And it's something where it felt very solid. But as a Buddhist, I'm like, well, it's not real because nothing is inherently real, but it's not real because I had a very felt experience. And it did something for me. It spurred me on. I actually wrote a prayer, which got published on Lion's Roar, right after I had this experience. So I know that like you can encounter people who get very woo about these things and they kind of put it out there. And one of the things about woo is for me, if you can tell that it's woo, is it's something that someone's doing to build themselves up or like wrap themselves in some sort of ego, that kind of thing. How do you work with that or with other people? Or do you?
I just say take it all with a grain of salt.
Yeah.
Like, if it feels real to you and you're inspired to do a thing based upon, a piece of celery talking to you, whatever that looks like, and it has uplifted you, amazing. And I am not somebody who's going to come in and delegitimize that. But at the point that woo becomes about the ego versus about the thing itself or the tangibility or the, how do I place it in context of my lived experience in this reality? That's where things get a little bit, and I like to cite, like, I want to say about, like, was it 10 years ago? Dang. About 10 years ago, I went to a pagan, like, there are these, like, all over the country, these big kind of pagan weekend camping sprees is what I like to call them, And this one woman took up, I want to say, a good hour and a half of a community town hall of like 1,500 people talking about how she went to the woods and met these elves. And it just so happens that they spoke English. And it was all this kind of, how would I put it? It was this spinning a narrative for me, which seemed about creating a name for herself and taking up time and space to proclaim that she had an experience with a thing, in a setting which wasn't about that, where that became the woo. And regardless of whether or not she, like, how she embodied that later on in life and came to terms with that in that specific moment and in the communication of it, it felt very woo. And hell, I speak to trees all the time, but you don't see me taking up every, 5 hours of everybody's, day just to talk about my experience of a tree or a bird or, whatever. And that's not to say that I couldn't, You know, like that's every day. That's not anything special, you know?
I think that's it for me is there's one thing that I use is it's not about you. Whereas like if I'm presenting this in a way where I'm trying to make it about me, then it stops being about the practice and stops being about and it just becomes about my ego. And then
Yeah.
also, yeah, a lot of it is just very ordinary. I totally talk to trees all the time. I like hugging them as well. It's good
Yes.
fun
I
hugging a
mean,
tree.
I talk to my spirits on the toilet. You know what I mean? Like wherever I'm at, they're just constantly there, and they're also not there at the same time. Like I can also recognize where sometimes it's my own mental processes and me working through a thing, and being able to differentiate between the two is, you know, something that I'm definitely in the and still learning how to do. But yeah, that's definitely part of, for me, like the process of differentiation, you know?
I think that one of the appeals of indigenous spirituality is for a lot of people is how holistic it is. And the emphasis as well and the connection to nature is really important to a lot of people. And for me, I know that I've definitely moved through the realization of like, oh, I am nature, whether I feel that or not. Which it was actually something a friend said to me years ago that made me realize this and bring it into my life all the time. Is she said how funny it is that if we see a termite mound, we'll be like, that's natural. But if we look at an office building, we're like, that's unnatural. But it's like, how is it really different? Because we built it. And we are natural. So it's like part of nature. But it's one thing to, again, have that intellectual, like, oh, and then another thing to embody it. So, what would you say you do to really embody that connectivity so you aren't just paying it lip service? Like you've already said, you talk to trees.
Yeah. I mean, for me, one of the biggest things is coming out of consumerism of the thing. And so with my community of people, like, and this is just within the last 3 years because I've had the privilege of having spaces where I could have a garden and start growing my traditional herbs and medicines versus buying it from a store. You know, what does it look like to, you know, with beads and things like that, which are, you know, there are certain, they're called the lekes, which are the spiritual necklaces, which represent the, you know, the spirit, which get washed and prayed over and yada, 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 and initiation happens and they get presented. You know, what does it look like for me to pray over each bead as I string it on the string versus going to a metaphysical, you know, resource center and like buying it for $3, you know? And that's not to say that that isn't like buying a thing isn't as valid as making it yourself, but that's my way of kind of connecting to ground, like grounding it in my experience versus just how can I get a thing to do a thing.
So it's
I don't know
actually
if that was answering your or part of answering your question. I know I just kind of jumped topics, but.
No, I think that does make sense, right? Because it's that sort of when we think of human beings as unnatural, or we think of what we make as unnatural, it's understanding how we come to that connection in our mind. And a lot of it is because of that separation we feel, right? Like there's this illusion that we are separate, and it is just an illusion. And there are different things we can do to realize that it's an illusion where we can just sit there and really contemplate it, which I do when I meditate, like largely what I am doing. But there is something about the physical aspect of going out and touching things and buying it from somebody or finding out how to source it or appreciating the time and energy and effort that goes into getting something in its more raw form in order to move it into whatever form you want it to be in to be able to use it in the way you want to use it. And that then, like, you start to really see interconnectedness and it becomes impossible to avoid it. And because I think with consumer culture, right, like, if, especially when you can order something online, you don't see the person in the warehouse who's going to go and grab that thing. And you don't see whoever it was who sent the thing to the warehouse and whoever harvested the thing and assembled the thing. And you miss all that. It's still there. But you miss all of it.
And it's almost like going back to what we were talking about, like the idea of lineage, you know? Where does this specific thing come from, and who laid their hands on it, and what, you know, and also not everything in nature is peaceful and beautiful. And I mean, there's some scary ass shit. Like, I don't want to, I mean, tigers are beautiful, but do I want to be next to one? No. You know what I mean? Like, not every herb that, you know, is out there is going to, you know, heal me or like have some beautiful message. Like, there's a lot of very real, you know, survival type of stuff in nature.
Nature is intense.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, growing up on a chicken farm, that was not pretty. Like, that was not, you know, I like my comfort. I like being able to sit on a couch, you know, and I'm not going to be shamed for doing that. You know what I mean? I'm not, you know, I like going to a spa and getting a massage. You know what I mean? Like,
who
those
doesn't?
Are things that, hello.
Yeah.
So I'm not trying to say that just because it's natural or you live close to the land, that that's any better or any worse than industrialization. But because I do get a lot of, Western medicine, mean, electricity, like all these things are things that are part of my natural lived experience here in the States. But whenever I went to Africa, like, that was a totally different experience and situation. And, you know, seeing the result of colonialization there was just like horrifying, you know? Yeah. So I think that it's what you're like, I'm just babbling now.
It's complicated, basically. It's a complicated thing. And it's not, as my other teacher, Elizabeth Matthes Namgyel, puts it, nothing is ever just one way.
Yeah.
And so there's nothing inherently bad about industrialization. It's just understanding how to recognize what's putting you to sleep versus what's waking you up and what's helping you connect versus, because you can totally be out in nature and be totally disconnected from nature. It's very possible, you know, people
and
walking,
wanting to run away from it.
If someone walking in the woods and they've got their headphones in and they're listening to music and kind of, not that there's anything wrong with listening to music, but they're like in their brain, in their head, totally not connected with anything around them at all, possibly not even the music they're listening to. It's not a default. And that nature as well, I think you're right. People think like nature's all lovely and soft and wonderful. Like,
there are some absolutely horrifying things in nature. Like, I mean, plutonium. Let's get that, you know, let's start. Hello. Like, not everything that's natural.
Deserts.
Is, you know, yeah, exactly. No.
So my final question is, what are signposts or guidance that you found really essential or helpful that you'd like to offer to listeners?
Can you unpack that for me, maybe a little bit more?
Unpack. Okay. Generally, my final question really is for people to share resources that have worked for them. And I get various responses. So that's why I usually leave it as it is, because it depends on what people say. So some people will say, oh, this is books that are really good. There's this particular teacher I like. There's a podcast I like. There was one person, and her response was amazing, was go out and engage with other cultures and learn about them and participate in their ceremonies. That was her response, which, again, I just left it very wide open with signposts that you would give to people. It could be a tangible thing. It could be an active thing and whatever.
I love it. I love it. Two different ways. On the more like spirituality based, you know, what are some practices that might be good for people to look into that might be effective for them? One of the core grounding teachings in more of the Orisha-based lineage, and actually one that I found in pretty much every earth-based tradition, which is going to sound very similar to some Buddhist practices. So the Ori is our own indwelling spirits. It could be translated as soul, but it's a little bit different. I mean, there's some deviations in that. And so the indwelling spirit in the Orisha tradition is seen as the highest god that ever exists.
Okay.
And that spirit, that our own indwelling spirits, has to consent to whatever we're doing before anything else can help us, even like quote-unquote Orisha or, you know, any other gods, goddesses, divinities that are out there. And so the practice is itself about understanding what our specific Oris, what our specific indwelling souls want and need and are communicating with us on a daily basis in order to manifest the lives that we want to live, right? And also what contracts they have made outside of our own embodied selves, even before they came into these human vessels. And that there are multiple form, like there are multiple components that dwell within different parts of our bodies, which have different voices. And so it's not just about bringing that, like all the different multivalence voices together in harmony, but then how does that harmony speak to the external world, right? And speak unified.
It does sound a lot like Buddhism.
I mean, it's crazy. Like the inner, I mean, it's absolutely crazy and beautiful. And as a tangent note, like there was a lot of discourse between Asia and Africa, throughout history. The idea that all these civilizations were detached from each other is just insane. So that's one of the big things in my tradition that I teach that on a fundamental level is, a understanding that that exists, and as much as anything exists as a form of reality. And B, like whatever that looks like in terms of practices, whether it's from Orisha, whether it's from a Buddhist perspective, from a Catholic perspective, from, whatever that speak to that form of inward authority and inward alignment, it is a big, that's it. Like that's the magic. Then on a more practical, like things that you can go out and read and resources, my grandfather in one of my lineages in Orisha is a man called Baba Ifa Karade. And he wrote the Handbook of Yoruba Religious Principles, which is absolutely phenomenal for people who want an introductory, like, what is Orisha practice? What does this look like? And in a liberation-based type of theology. Another elder would be Aina Alomo, who wrote Core of Fire, Yoruba Spiritual Activism, and something else. I forget what the other part of the title is.
Spiritual activism, that sounds awesome.
Oh yeah, like, and it's all about, I mean, there's amazing essays on the intersections of spiritual activism and like spirituality. I mean, there's just tons of stuff out there. I also love Elizabeth. Oh shoot, she's a theologian. Oh, she talks about the Pilgrim Church. And I read it in Queer Theory, and now it's leaving my mind. But I thought that was absolutely revolutionary. And what she was talking about was this idea of spiritual practices as a way of bringing communities together to go towards liberation, and that it was a form of spiritual pilgrimage. And that's what she calls it, like the idea of the Pilgrim Church.
Like
It's
Martin
one of
Luther
those
King.
hyphen. Yeah, exactly. Hello. So I love her and her theology. Judith Butler and interdependence, and the ways in which she talks about like the interdependence of things is a very spiritual. Like for me, I'm like, oh, that's complete spirit. Like that's and gender play and all that kind of stuff. I mean, there's so many people that I want to send. Like I'm just like throwing resources at people all the time. Oh, and in terms of pagan bloggers who people might be interested in, there's a woman by the name of Crystal Blanton. She's brilliant, and I love her work and what she, what she's doing here in the Bay Area and nationally. She's absolutely brilliant. So any of those, all of those would be great
And if people
resources.
want to connect with you.
I have my own website, www.luflores.com. I'm also opening up a metaphysical shop, an online metaphysical shop, and it's Bell Book and Candle Yield Magic Shop.
Awesome.
And I know, right? And
Yes.
it's www.bbcmagick.com. And that should be open within this next week or so.
Cool. I'll include those in the site or the show description as well.
Thank
People
you,
will
thank you.
click through. Oh, of course. Thank you so much for listening. If you would like to connect with Lou or find out more about any of these practices, visit louflores.com. To find out more about what I do, visit kaylinschatch.com, where you can sign up to get my monthly wrap-up email, read my blog, check out my artwork, and leave a tip to help support the show. Thank you as well to Dexter Britton for composing the fantastic music accompanying this and the previous two seasons of Everything is Workable.